I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. This is going to be episode number 262.
That's Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcaster. You could check him out on Twitter at ATFMB. My name is John Anilio. I'm a musician and a podcaster and a teacher. You can check me out at John Anilio on Twitter. And wow, are we excited tonight? We have Brandon Sanderson on the show. I'm just gonna lead right with it. I always talk a lot about Brandon's books. I'm a big fan. This is going to for sure devolve into a very Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney kind of interview. Like, hey, remember that time when you wrote about Kaladin? Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Oh, it's a real treat for us. As I said, I am a big fan. I've read a lot of your books. Now, it's funny, I'm not up to date on the Mistborn series but I did read both Stormlight Archives books. So that's like 12 million pages right there. Yeah. I recommend those to everybody I meet. And I'm obviously a big fan of Elantris. And I really liked the Reckoners books. I've read both of them. And I know the new one of that is coming out soon, too. So there's lots of stuff to talk about. But The Bands of Mourning is the new one that is out as we speak, I believe. So maybe you can tell people a little bit about that and where they can get it and all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. So I did this weird thing with the Mistborn series. I love epic fantasy. I've been reading it since I was a kid. And kind of one of my goals as a writer was to add something to the discussion, not just kind of retread. And one of the things I noticed about epic fantasy, and it's actually something I enjoy about it, so it's not necessarily a bad thing, but a lot of epic fantasy has this sort of, we don't change. The same cycle has gone on for many years, and it's been 5,000 years, and we still kind of have the same tech level. That's actually fun. It's one of these things you can delve into some certain ideas in a story like that you can't in another one. But with Mistborn, one of my original pitches to myself on this series was I was going to try to do in each book what you would see an entire series do in, you know, many volumes. I was going to try to kind of condense them and pack them together. And because of that, I wanted to move the time scale forward. My original pitch to my editor, I came to him, I said, okay, here, this is weird. Listen to this. But what I want to do is I want to do an epic fantasy trilogy. And then I want to jump forward and do an urban fantasy trilogy, in which the epic fantasy trilogies become the foundation of myth and of religion and all of these things for an urban fantasy culture with, you know, very much a lot of modern devices and take on things. And then I wanted to jump forward again and do a science fiction trilogy, a space opera, in which the magic has become the means by which space travel is possible. And so I wanted to kind of take this fantasy world and see how far I could push it. So the newest one, Bands of Mourning, is the third in the second trilogy of more modern urban fantasy things. They take place about 1910, 1920s level technology. It's not a one-to-one correlation, but, you know, it's the advent of automobiles taking over and things like this. In this world that used to be an epic fantasy world, and our protagonists in this one are more detectives. They're less, you know, epic fantasy heroes and more, you know, a cop on the streets in this city that is kind of outgrowing itself and all of these sorts of things. So, you know, that's not a pitch of Bands of Mourning itself. It's a pitch of the second trilogy. A lot of people like them better than the originals. A lot of people like the originals better. You're never going to get an exact agreement on that, but it is a lot of fun to see something very different.
So I'm curious, you jumped ahead in the story. You said, I pitched this to my editor, and then you went to talking about the book. What about the conversation in between where the editor was like, no?
The editor didn't say, ha, no. What he actually said is, wow, you're ambitious. This was the, you know, he bought Elantris from me. And he was asking what I wanted to do next. And this is what I pitched to him. And so, yeah, he said, wow, you're ambitious. How about you just do that epic fantasy trilogy and see if it works? He's a good editor. He knew that's the way to approach these crazy authors. So I did. I wrote the epic fantasy trilogy. I felt it worked pretty well. And so then I jumped forward, which, you know, it's been a really fun and different experience to write in a world where your own trilogy has become the lore of the world, which it's a lot of fun.
That's amazing.
I have so many questions, but before we go off on a tangent, let's get into our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Brandon, what's your pick this week?
So I've got a fun story with this one. I was on tour, and when I'm on tour, people like to give me things. They just come through the line and hand me things. And sometimes it's cookies. Sometimes it's a book they wrote, which I'm also always really honored to receive because, you know, I'm a writing professor. Helping people write is one of the fulfilling things I do. It's one of my life goals. And so when they bring me their books, they're like, you know, I know you probably can't read all of these that you get, but here's a book that I wrote because of the things you said. That's really cool. But this time it was different. Someone brought me something and said, here is something I have loved that I want to share with you. And it was a graphic novel that I'd never heard of. It's an independent fantasy graphic novel. And I like comic books. I'd never heard of this one, but I like comic books. And the book is called Birthright. He gave me the collection, Birthright Volume 1, Homecoming.
Yep.
Have you read that?
I have, yes. I reviewed it for Kirkus.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yep, loved it.
Well, it's by Andre Besson, Joshua Williamson. Amazon is not giving me the last person's name. Adriano Lucas. I want to make sure I get everybody's names in there. This was great. It was totally not what I was expecting.
Right.
It starts off, it's got this father with his kids, and they're in our world, they're playing ball out in the forest, and one of the kids wanders out, I think he's like 8 years old or something like that, disappears. And then you jump forward a year, and the dad's like an alcoholic. Everyone accuses him of killing his son. His marriage has fallen apart. And his supposedly 8-year-old son comes through a portal into our world, now is a fully grown man, like a barbarian, bristling with magic weapons and a huge beard, and saying, I have come to chase down the evil wizards which have escaped into our world. I need to find my father and brother to help me on this quest. And it's just a delightful, unexpected take on the kind of heroic fantasy trope.
Yep.
It's got this great relationship between this guy who's now, you know, fully grown, but his older brother is, you know, 10 or 12 or whatever, and his dad, who everyone accused of killing him, who's not sure if he believes if he's really this kid or not. Anyway, I can't recommend it enough. It's great.
I love the little moments between the older brother, air quotes,
yeah,
and the younger brother, who is now way older.
You know, right,
there's these
right.
moments where they just have these memories and these connections.
Yeah, and it really works well also because the older brother in some ways is still older because the younger brother didn't have a childhood. He got thrown into this huge fantasy war, and there are certain things in him that got stunted growth-wise. And so in some ways, his older brother, who's 10, is wiser than he is. But in some ways, he knows nothing at all about life compared to this guy who's lived through wars and things like this. The writing is really good. The art is really good. I recommend it. It's great.
It turns all of those tropes on their heads.
Yeah, and that's what I love. I love seeing things that, you know, you can appreciate this if you've never read fantasy before. But if you have, you can say, ah, these are the tropes that the author is playing with. And it's really fun to see that. As a fan of the genre, it's one of the things, like I said, it builds upon the genre. It adds something new. It takes us in different directions. It builds upon our shared knowledge of the genre. That's the sort of books that I really love. They can go either way. The ones that get super, super meta, I don't always like, right, because they become so self-referential. I mean, they can be a lot of fun, but they need some other connection. John Scalzi's Red Shirts did this, right? It was meta, and you were like, oh, this is just going to be silly. But then they added in some really deep character moments he did, and it brought it together, particularly the codas. So it becomes this sort of thing that is both really fun if you know the genre, but also completely relatable if you don't. Those are my favorite kind of books.
Cool. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
Well, John, there is some very low-hanging fruit that I'm just going to pluck from the sky. The X-Files. The X-Files are back on TV. You know, I feel like it's the 90s. First, it was Arsenio Hall, right? He was back. And you've got Clinton and Bush in a presidential run again. Mm-hmm. And now the X-Files are here. So, I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's nostalgia for some reason. I've seen the first episode as of this recording. I have the second one on my DVR. I haven't seen that yet. But it's interesting, you know, it takes you back. And I used to be a huge X-Files fan. I loved the X-Files. That was what I watched every week. And I even wrote some of the first stories I wrote were essentially X-Files fan fiction, right? So I'm just happy to see it back on the air, and I hope it does better than the 6-hour, 24-hour thing that they did with Jack Bauer. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, cool. Yeah, no, I've been reading a lot about that. I've been seeing it, and seems it's kind of a mixed response so far, from what I could tell. But they've got time. Cool. My pick this week is Half the World by Joe Abercrombie. This is the second part in Joe Abercrombie's trilogy. It's really interesting because I've seen this, sort of plugged as being YA, and I suppose it is, but it's. I don't know. I'm not sure of the now. Brendan, you write some YA as well. Mm-hmm. So, what do you think differently when you're writing YA, or are there particular kind of constraints or parameters?
You know, it's really weird to talk about this. I read a lot of YA, and I write YA, and YA is in that weird middle ground. Now, middle grade, which is the age right younger. Middle grade, you definitely do things differently. Middle grade is a very different beast. YA, the thing about it is, number one, YA generally isn't edited for content. And so, there's not those constraints. YA, you generally are not changing any plot lines. You don't want to simplify. Teens will tell if you're writing down to them, right? Mm-hmm. And so... the big difference that I notice in a lot of YA is they tend to be streamlined storylines. Generally, the teens are not going to put up with you messing around and wasting their time. And so it tends to get into the story faster. It tends to have a more streamlined viewpoint. Viewpoint tends to be to reign supreme in YA. If you can get a good voice, that's one of the things that that seems like the readers look for the most. And then you usually are limiting the number of protagonists to one or two so you can tell a tighter story. And that's kind of it. I mean, it's this weird thing. YA, it's like it's a story about a teen. Does that automatically make it YA? Well, what would you do different if it weren't a YA story? I don't think anyone really knows. I think that there's a lot of just instinct that goes on and just a lot of marketing speak. Like you write the book, you write the best book you can, you hand it to the people and they say, we're going to decide this is YA. And they put it in YA. I've had a lot of friends that's how it's gone. With The Reckoners, I specifically wanted to write a YA story, primarily because I had a great voice for a teen character, an older teen character. And I said, this is what feels right to me for this audience. But you really can't write down. And a lot of the classic fantasy books that were published when I was a teen, they would be probably published as YA right now. We've got Sword of Shannara that's coming out as the MTV show, and that would be published as YA today. I remember being a kid and getting Anne McCaffrey books from the children's section in my library and being offended. I'm like, Anne McCaffrey is not children's. I read books that are not children's books. But the librarian said, that's where the teens go, and these are the books the teens like. So I just put them where the teens can get them, and that's my job. And she was doing the right job. So I don't think that anyone can give you a real hard, fast answer. Maybe some good teen librarians could do that.
I remember reading Shannara on a plane. And this attractive young lady leaned over and said, oh, are you reading the Shannara books? I'm like, yeah. She says, yeah, I read those when I was 15.
Yeah. I often like the YA. I'm not widely read in YA, but I often really enjoy it. I think for that reason, because of the tight focus, and it does kind of get to the point. And I think these books, the book one was Half a King, This is Half a World, and there's one more book in the series that's out already. And I think that's what I like about it. It is kind of a limited viewpoint. There's usually, in this book, there's two viewpoint characters, and that's it. And you can really follow the story pretty closely. But in terms of content, you know, it's pretty violent. It's got some pretty adult themes. I mean, it's not gore. I've not read Abercrombie's other stuff, and I know he kind of has a reputation for being pretty brutal.
Just a little.
Yeah.
I mean, he is on Twitter listed as Lord Grimdark. So,
yeah. So I guess for his standards, this may be not very violent at all.
Have you read Brent Weeks' stuff yet, John?
I have read Brent Weeks, yes.
Yeah, that could be a little violent too.
Yeah, I read the first part in the Night Angel trilogy.
I really like his Lightbringer a little bit better. I think he's more developed as a writer when he writes those. And he knows just how to build his magic system a little bit better and to, yeah, I really like Lightbringer books. I liked the Night Angel okay. I didn't like them nearly as much, though.
A lot of people talk about the magic system in the Lightbringer books as being one of the more balanced and really good ones. So I believe you.
It's really interesting. Yeah. And a good magic system, in my opinion, kind of interconnects with the world and is important to the world and the characters, but it doesn't.
A good magic system?
Yeah, a good magic system. Does not become like the story can't be about the magic system, the story has to be about the characters. It can be about the characters interfacing with the magic system in the same way a great science fiction story is about characters interfacing with the science. But, you know, that's a hard balance to walk. You don't want your story to just be, you know, look at this cool magic. You want your story to be, look at these cool people and what the magic is doing to them.
That's very cool. And you mentioned people bringing you gifts. I'm wondering, do people still bring you magic cards?
They do still bring me magic cards. In fact, I had to stop tweeting when I got a magic card from fans because if I did that at the next signing, there is one signing where people brought me something like 45 packs of magic cards.
Holy crap.
And I'm like, oh, this is what Neil Gaiman calls using your powers for evil instead of good. Or maybe not evil, maybe just selfishness. I'm like, I can't tweet about this because then people know I like them and they want to give me gifts. And I feel awesome. It's like, great, thank you. But at the same time, you know, the real gift is coming and meeting me and reading the books and things like that. I don't want people to feel like they have to bring me anything.
Right.
So,
no, I understand. I was just curious.
At cons, I will usually do a magic draft with fans.
Yes, I've seen that. And for the benefit of the listeners, I held up a magic card when he was talking about magic systems. Because I almost asked you what was on your trade list, so.
Yeah, right now, mostly, I'm trying to foil out my cube. So it's a long process.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what I'd like to transition to is, you know, I just, like I said, I've read a lot of your book, but I actually just started reading the Mistborn series recently. And when I was doing a little research prior to the interview, it had said that one of the things you'd pitched for the book was that it was going to be an epic fantasy, but a heist caper. And you actually mentioned the movie Sneakers. And,
yeah, oh, I love that movie.
Let's talk about Sneakers because Patrick and I think, have both talked about how we loved Sneakers. I saw it. That came out in 92, and I believe I was a freshman in college, and it was one of those times where I was not watching TV at all because I was in school, and this was at a time where we didn't have as much TV in school. So, you know, it was – I didn't see any previews for it. We just went – saw it, and it's one of my favorite movies to this day. So maybe you could tell us a little bit what your feelings about that movie are, and the influence that it had on your writing.
So I like a good heist, and my love of heist actually came from Sneakers. It was loving Sneakers that, you know, it's kind of the reverse. Like The Sting, I hadn't seen until I saw Sneakers and loved it. My friends are like, oh, you need to see The Sting. And you know, you need to see a lot of these classics, heist stories. And that's where I came to love this idea of the ensemble. What I love about a good heist is that you usually have a group of people, each with something they're adding to the team. And usually, you know, Stinkers is a great example. They're adding something really unique, whether it's, you know, it's Mother who can hear, you know, he hears like nobody else. And that scene in Sneakers where he is figuring out where another character was taken in the trunk of a car by having him describe the sounds of the road is just so cool. It's a superpower. I mean, it's exaggerated. I don't think someone could really do that. But it's this idea that they're bringing these really quirky, interesting things. And then, you know, kind of their broken personalities. That's what Sneakers is about. They're all messed up in some interesting way. And they're bringing this all together to this functional team of people who individually would be highly unfunctional or incapable of doing anything in life. But together, they pull off great stuff. And I really, really love that dynamic. And it you see echoes of it moving through my fiction. The best heist story I think we've had recently was Inception. And it does kind of the same thing. You've got all this team with everybody, very interesting things that they're bringing to the team. And I really enjoyed that movie for a lot of the same reasons. When I was building Mistborn, I was looking at doing that, but the things everyone would bring to the team was a different magical talent. And it's very interesting because I had said at the time, I'm like, I don't see any really good heist fantasies going on. And of course I released this and then Lies of Lamora comes out about the same time, which, if you're just looking at the heist aspect, Lies of Lamora is a better heist than mine is. Mine, I think is a great book. But it's more epic fantasy. As I was writing it, I'm like, you know, I'm building an epic fantasy trilogy out of this. I'm going to pull back on the heist a little bit and push forward on the epic fantasy, you know, the protagonist learning how to use the magic and learning how to infiltrate noble society and things like that were really interesting to me and became a big part of it. But the fun thing in Mistborn, and I won't spoil it for those who haven't read, the real heist is going on behind the scenes and you never see it until the ending. And that's the sort of thing that I really like about heist is sometimes when you can heist the audience, if that makes sense. And that I still managed to pull off as kind of the undercurrent of that book. And it is part of why the book works, is this kind of hidden heist.
See, and that's why I like the TV show Leverage and the new one, yeah. Scorpion. It's the same concept.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, it's all these people who have these incredible skill, right? They have some incredible skill, but the one thing they can't do is interact with other people.
Right,
it's
right.
Like they're all awkward, right? They don't belong anywhere except together.
I was disappointed in the Mission Impossible movies, though there are good movies. I've enjoyed every one of them, but they're not heists.
Right.
Is the problem? Like not traditional heists. They are spy thrillers.
Yeah.
And I can understand why they did that. The spy thriller is a little bit more marketable, I suppose. And if you've got a really compelling lead, then go with that. But they're spy thrillers instead of heists. And the old television show was about doing a heist every week.
Right. The movies are more about Tom Cruise.
Yeah, they are.
And what crazy stunt is he willing to do this time?
Yep. And they do get crazy.
Yep.
I'll give him that. Man, when he was dangling outside that building in Dubai, he really did that.
Well, he really did the plane thing in the latest one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the new one. I haven't seen the new one yet.
Hanging off the side of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. You know, and kind of transitioning again, you know, one of the things that I came across, a lot of our listeners, I think, are creatives as well. And I think a lot of people do participate in NaNoWriMo, and I found out that that Way of Kings, the first book in the Stormlight Archives, actually started as a NaNoWriMo novel before you were. Yes, kind of. Maybe you could tell us a little bit of the kind of.
And I'm curious because the goal is 50,000 words. So what'd you do the other 3 weeks?
Yeah. NaNoWriMo as a thing was getting big in the late 90s, early 2000s. And a lot of my writing friends really got into it. My children are running around. I hope you guys can't hear that.
That's okay.
It's okay.
So my friends were all doing it. Now, I didn't need motivation to write. By that point, I had built good writing habits. By the time NaNoWriMo was getting big, I'd written 8 or 9 novels already. And so I did it every year to support my friends meaning I posted my word counts on our forum, the forum I had with my friends. And then we'd all post our word counts, and it would kind of help each other get along. And in 2002, Way of Kings was the book I was working on. I was actually working on the ending of it when November came along. So I often say I've never technically won NaNoWriMo because I've never started a new book and then done 50,000 words of it. I've always just been in the process of a book. And I write 50,000 words of it and post my word counts with my friends. Or this year I just posted them on Twitter. And, you know, I'll do the 50,000 words. In this case, I finished Way of Kings as part of that 50,000 words. But it isn't different than what I did every month leading up to that. And so it's this weird thing. It was a NaN novel, kind of. Do you see what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, because I'm always sort of – a book length is always kind of an elusive thing to me in as a reader, because we're fortunate to get a lot of books sent to us, and I read quite a bit, and I never can tell certain books, you know, in terms of, you know, because you have page size and print size and the way it's formatted and all that kind of stuff. So
there's a formula you can do, John. You can actually look at the page count. You can look at the page size, and they have this formula that tells you exactly how many words are in it and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, well, I'd like to find that out at some point. But
it's a publishing thing, John.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I'm unaware of that. Typically, you know, so I did read both of the Stormlight Archive books, which are I think both are in the neighborhood of 1,000 pages. So what is the word count on a book of that length?
So we all count in words in the industry just because of this. The page numbers are all very mutable. The Stormlight books are around 400,000 words each. So to give some perspective, I can count off my books. I'm not as good at using others, but the Reckoner's books are around 100,000. Mm-hmm. So about a fourth of the Way of Kings. The Mistborn original trilogy, they range around 200 to 250, depending on the book. The new Wax and Wayne Mistborn books are back down to about 100. Novellas that you'll read, most of those will be around 30,000 words. And most YA books are around 70 to 80.
And John, mm-hmm. for the debut author, you're shooting for around 65 to 70,000 words just to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And then once you've proven mm-hmm. yourself, and then they'll let you start doing things like Brandon does.
Yeah, no, this is a do as I say, not as I do. Elantris was 250,000 words. We cut it to 200 after it was accepted for publication because it was a little bloated. Patrick is right. You really I say it this way, though. Every book that you write as a new writer that you're trying to publish, it's going to have some things about it that are going to go against the grain. Every book should break the rules in some way. Right. If it doesn't, then the chances are that you're just like trying to chase the market or something like that. So every book's going to there'll be these lists of rules you should follow. One of those is new writer. You want your book to come in. If it's a science fiction book, 80,000 words is really kind of a magic number. If it's a fantasy, you can usually go to like 100, 120. But that's pushing it. Those are the guidelines. And the reason for this, the editor's going to look at that. They're going to be really skeptical. Of this big long book, and the reader's going to do the same thing. They're going to be like, wow, there's this big long book, and it says book one of seven, and it's the only book that's out, and I've never heard of this author. I don't know if I trust that author to give me an ending. I don't know. I won't know if I really get a good ending till I get to the end of this 1,000-page book, and then if it's a bad ending, I'm going to spend all this time, and it's going to leave this bad taste in my mouth. And so there's some subconscious things going on in there, and there's a reason why we didn't publish Way of Kings until – I kind of said, okay, fans, you can trust me to give you an ending now. Here's your book. And those number of words, I mean, there are things you can do in a book like that you can't do in another book. I plot each book of the Stormlight Archive like a trilogy. So between those pages of The Way of Kings or Words of Radiance, there's actually three books worth of material that I've plotted and arced about the same way that I plot and arc a trilogy. And then I actually write a short story collection, and I intersperse them. As big parts of the book are done, I'll say end of part one. I'll put in three short stories in the world that kind of give you and expand the world for you. And then I'll jump back to the main characters and do part two. And so it's four books in one. And that's why it's 400,000 words. It's 300,000 words of a three-book trilogy and then a short story collection interspersed in between it. All to kind of try and give you this experience by calling it a single volume, that you get done with it and you feel like you've read something really weighty. You've gotten a lot of these different characters in this world and things like that. And it's really fun. It's my favorite thing to do because of how much goes into bringing these books together. But boy, is it a lot of work. And I don't know that I would ever recommend that someone read The Way of Kings as the first book of mine that they try, because I'd rather that they trust me first.
Wow. Yeah, it brings a point, and you mentioned that, and you mentioned some of the things that you did during NaNoWriMo, and that I'd love it if you could tell us what, maybe even if you just start with your morning. What does your morning look like? Because obviously you must have some systems in place in terms of how you write, because you do have such a high output. So, you know, when you wake up, what does your day look like for the first, say, 90 minutes? What are you doing in the first 90 minutes of your day typically? If like on a good day, like not on a day we have to travel to, like, you know, we have to travel for a con or something like that.
Yeah. So the first thing is, you mentioned morning. I'm sleeping through the morning. I'm a writer. I didn't get into this so I could get up at 8 o'clock. So I actually get up at noon most days.
Oh, I envy you so hard right now.
It is so nice.
I'm still wearing the day job shirt.
Very long-suffering, wonderful wife who is a bit more of a morning person than me. And so she will get up and, you know, boot the kids off to school and things like that. And I will get up at noon. My first 90 minutes look like checking my email to make sure there's no fires in New York. Occasionally there are where they're like, we can't get a hold of Brandon. This is really needs to be changed. Something's happening. And, you know, I'm getting up at noon. It's 2 o'clock their time. They're worked up into a panic by about that point. Hopefully my assistants have been managing things. Usually I will, go to the gym. I go to the gym mostly because I find it good writing time. I turn on music. I get on the treadmill or the elliptical or something like that. And, moving for some reason is just really good for thinking for me. And I found that's for a lot of people. And so if I'm moving and there's music going on, I can go through, all right, here's what I'm going to do for the day. This is what my writing is going to look like today. I get back at about 1 o'clock and I start writing. I write from one until about five. And that's, you know, usually hardcore writing time, working on whatever project I need to be doing new fiction on, if I'm allowed to, if I don't have revisions due or something like that. At that point, I take a shower and go hang with my family. 5:30 till around 8:30 is family time.
Nice.
And unless I'm doing promotion, unless there's a new book out or something like that, I make sure that that's family time. It's something I had to get used to, is because this job is one that you can do all the time. And I found that if I didn't like set and say, look, this is family time, I can't be writing during this time, I'd always be thinking still about the stories I'm going to be working on rather than, you know, playing Lego Dimensions with my kids or whatever it is they want to do. And so I do that, and then I will go back to work at around 10. Depends on, you know, what we're doing, if the wife and I go out on a date or something like that or whatnot. But about 10 is when I go back to work most nights. And I will then work from 10 until, you know, 2 or 3 usually. And that isn't always hardcore writing time. A lot of that is answering email, working on blog posts. Usually there'll be 2 or 3 hours in there of really good writing time. And then all the other stuff that comes with being a writer, people don't understand how much this is like being a small business owner and how much of it, you know, you have to be looking at, all right, what do I need with the employees? What do they need from me? I need to do art reviews. I need to do, you know, this and that and this and that. And so writing newsletters and going on Reddit and doing AMAs and things like that. I try to do those things around that time and then go to bed. So that's my working day.
Do you still teach?
I do. I teach, but I only teach one class. It's how to write science fiction and fantasy. And I teach it as an evening class one night a week for a 3-hour block. I just can't get to the campus and teach, you know, 3 1-hour sessions.
Sure.
So, and I do, part of my requirement for teaching that class is that they let me record it and I put it up on YouTube. And I don't do it every year that I teach it, because I teach it every year. But every two or three years, we're doing one right now where I'm recording the sessions. And we put them up on YouTube for anybody if they want to see what a university, how to write science fiction fantasy course is like.
Do you ever travel and teach at like workshops, writer's workshops and stuff like that?
I do. If I get invited to a con, I usually say, hey, can I do one of my lectures? People tend to like those. Once in a while, I'll go to writing workshops. For my podcast, Writing Excuses, we generally do a big workshop once a year that people could sign up for. We last year did it as a cruise because it turned out to be cheaper than any of the other options, which was ironic to me. That's the best way if you want me to be reading your writing is to find me at a workshop like that. A lot of people like try to hand me stuff on tour and I'm like, I just can't read this while I'm on tour, too much going on. So I teach the class and I do the workshops, and that's the way to get some advice on your writing in person, but it's hard. It's hard to find time to do all that.
I am going to send you an email.
Okay.
I work with the Pikes Peak Writers Conference in Colorado Springs.
Yeah. So has an excellent reputation.
It is, yes. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. Sorry, John, I'm hijacking the podcast.
No.
We are running out of time, though.
Yeah. So, you know, one final thing that I wanted to ask you before we do wrap it up.
Is it about Matt Cawthon? Because I thought he did. he didn't. Oh, it was so great. It was awesome. I loved it, Matt.
Oh, thank you.
He was the character I was so worried about. Anyway, go ahead, John.
The one I was going to say was you mentioned briefly your YA series, The Reckoners, and the next book of the series, The Calamity. Now, is that going to be the final book in that series?
Dun, dun, dun.
It's done.
Oh, that's great. I love that series too. So maybe you could just give a little brief thing about that before we wrap it up.
Sure. I love that. I love finishing things. And I like that this is going to be a complete trilogy. For those who aren't familiar with the books, it started because I almost got in a car wreck. I was driving to a signing and somebody cut me off in traffic. One of those, they pulled out, didn't see me. And, you know, there was no wreck. It was fine. But I had a little moment of just like sheer, oh, if you would have gotten me in this wreck, I would have missed my book signing. It was, you know, not a healthy emotion. And being the fantasy writer I am, my thought that popped in my head was, you're so lucky, person in front of me, that I don't have superpowers. Because if I did, I would just blow your car up right now. Nice, had a little Michael Bay effect in my head as I drove through the exploding car, smoke and stuff like that. And then I was immediately horrified because I'm like, wow, here I've written these fantasy novels about people that get these powers. And what do? They go around protecting people. And what would I do? I would be blowing up the cars of people who mildly inconvenience me on the road. And that became a story. That's where these things often come from, is events in your life like that. And I started, you know, I'm a comic book nerd. I started wondering what happens if people start gaining superpowers, but there are no heroes. Everyone just uses them selfishly, right? It felt like an interesting take on the superhero mythos. And so I wrote Steelheart as the story of a young man whose father is killed by basically an evil Superman / Captain Marvel / kind of all powerful superhero, invulnerable, flying, shoots blasts from his hands type of iconic superhero. And there are no heroes. He's a villain. They all are. And so the kid joins a group of underground freedom fighters that what they do is they assassinate supervillains. They figure out what their weaknesses are. They find a way to negate their powers, and then they shoot him in the head or do something else and bring him down. And he wants to bring down Steelheart, the most powerful of these. I call them epics because superhero is trademarked by Marvel and DC
jointly.
Yes,
it is.
So I made sure not to step on that one. I'm very familiar with that.
Not a lot of people are.
I follow some indie comics, and so they complain about it, so I know about that. So I didn't fall into that trap myself. But, yeah, it's a fun sort of hybrid. It is heist-oriented because the heist is take down the supervillain, and how can we figure out who they are, what their weaknesses are, and how can we bring them down.
As an interesting side note, the term Dungeon Master is trademarked by Wizards of the Coast.
Oh, that's right. That's why everyone else has to use GM or Storyteller. Was that what it was for White Wolf? Yeah.
Yep. That's correct.
Well, that's good. Well, Brandon, we don't want to take up any more of your time. So thank you for all the time that you did give us. Before we wrap it up, so obviously one more time we want to say that the new book, Bands of Mourning, is out right now.
It is.
Yes. So go and get that at your bookstore or on Amazon or buy the ebook, buy the print book, is the audiobook out right away too?
Yep. Or does that audiobooks right away?
Go and get the audiobook. We're big fans of audiobooks here on this podcast, as many of our listeners are as well. So go and check all that out. Anything else in terms of maybe upcoming con appearances or anything like that that you would like to let our listeners know about?
I'll be doing Phoenix Comic Con this year, and I believe Dragon Con is the other big one I'll be doing. Nice. And if you guys haven't read any of my books, Bands of Mourning isn't the place to start, but Alloy of Law is the one that starts the cycle with these characters. So if the whole pitch of urban fantasy with a history steeped in epic fantasy is interesting to you, go pick up Alloy of Law.
Awesome. And last thing before we do go, we just want to let all of you know listening. Thank you for listening today. And we especially want to thank our patrons. We have over 40 patrons to this podcast for our Patreon account that if you get some value out of the show, if you get some entertainment, if you get some information, you get some cool interviews with great authors like Brandon Sanderson and other creative folks. And if you like that every week, go over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/functionalnerds, and pledge $1 a month or more, and it really helps us out with the show and all the costs of the show and helps us run it. So thank you. Go and check that out. Patrick, anything else before we wrap it up?
Nope, that was perfect.
All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?